my own religious path came to becoming a UU secular humanist by being raised an Episcopalian, as you heard earlier. I was a choir boy, acolyte, a Boy Scout with a God and Country Award. But then the 60s happened, bringing, among other things, college philosophy classes, the war in Vietnam, John Coltrane. Then came the next half century, the information age, when science and the technologies it spawned expanded our knowledge of reality exponentially. This began 400 years ago, along with the Enlightenment, but the rate of change keeps getting faster, to the point where it's becoming increasingly hard to imagine where it's taking us. As Lewis Jenkins points out in his poem, Change, all those things that have gone from your life, moon boots, TV trays, and the Soviet Union, things that seem to have vanished are really only changed. Dinosaurs didn't disappear from the earth, but evolved into birds. And crockpots became bread makers. Everything around you changes. It seems at times, only for a moment, that your wife, the woman you love, might actually be your first wife in another form. It's not a thought to be pursued. Nothing is the same as it used to be, except you, of course. You haven't changed. I'll slow down a little bit, perhaps. It's more difficult nowadays to deal with the speed of change. Disturbing to suddenly find yourself brushing your teeth with what appears to be a flashlight. But essentially, you're the same as ever, constant in your instability. In the spring of 1970, just shy of 23, I was living in a public housing project in Worcester, Massachusetts, as a member of the U.S. Teacher Corps, teaching at the project's elementary school there. One evening, I began to read a short book, Spiritual Exercises, The Saviors of God, by Nikos Kazantzakis, who later wrote The Last Temptation of Christ and, of course, Zorba the Greek. He was deeply influenced by Christianity, Buddhism, and Marxism. I remember clearly reading this because it was the only book I ever began reading early one evening and ended up reading and thinking about it until dawn. The premise of The Saviors of God was that God set the miracle of life in motion and wanted it to evolve to a distant omega point of freedom. And God rejoiced as life evolved into its incredible diversity and into man. And if, during the course of our lives, we expanded our freedom, he rejoiced again. And he rejoiced even more when some of us advanced the freedom of others. These were the saviors of God, the men and women of the great prophets of religions, political theorists, and leaders. It gave me an image of being like coral, each one having living on a reef of millions of ancestors, each making a contribution by living and dying, advancing the possibilities for future generations. That even if we can't expand the freedom of others, at least we can expand it for ourselves. Sorry about my throat. With the goal of making the world a better place for having lived in it. I later learned that the sand mandalas that Buddhist monks painstakingly make and then destroy are really the same concept. Our lives being like grains of sand, inheritors of all the generations of life that preceded us, yet short-lived and illusory. We Unitarians love to ponder the great mysteries, and there are many things to keep us pondering. But there are far fewer mysteries about our reality than ever, because science has eroded or knocked down the assumptions of so many religions, so many of the pillars of religion. We now know an enormous amount about the Earth, the evolution of life, our solar systems, planets and moons, and many, many other planets and moons. We're constantly learning much, much more about our galaxy and the thousands of others, as well as the subatomic world of quantum physics and the universe itself. It all makes the probability of a grand creator of it all highly unlikely, let alone a creator with a special focus on our lives, on this tiny blue dot, circling one of 2 billion stars in the Milky Way, one galaxy of possibly 2 trillion stars in the universe, which physicists now think may be just one of many, and the Big Bang probably originated in the world of quantum particles. We now know that time did not exist before the Big Bang because Einstein's theory of relativity, which is proven to be true, years ago when he first proposed it, was based on the fact that his equations of relativity showed that both the space and time coordinates of any event must get mixed up together by the mathematics in order to accurately describe what we see. And because space consists of three dimensions and time is one-dimensional, space-time must therefore be a four-dimensional object. Google four-dimensional space in Wikipedia and you'll see an animation which will make it a lot more clear. Physicists now know that our world's embedded in this four-dimensional time-space, in the space-time continuum, and all events, places, moments in history, and actions are described in terms of their location in space-time. Space-time does not evolve. It simply exists. It is the very fabric of our universe. Creation takes time. Billions and billions of years of random events, all governed by the laws of physics, which have causes and effects. So without time, nothing can be created, including the space-time object that is the universe. The universe could not have been created. That's hard to get our creative heads around. But as Neil deGrasse Tyson says in his best-selling book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, which is a short book, but it's incredible, and I really recommend you all read it. The universe is under no obligation to make sense to you. As the Spanish-American War was happening, the belief that God makes all things possible prompted Mark Twain to write, God created war so that Americans could learn geography. Science is also discovering new insights into the nature of consciousness. It seems that it may be related to the quantum world within the microtubules within all living cells, leaving us to realize that we humans are not nearly as unique as we thought. Getting back to my own spiritual path, flash forward to my life in the mid-90s, I found my then decade-long Unitarian self making a documentary for the Templeton Prize in Progress in Religion, which I called Divining the Divine. I hope you'll be able to watch it today at 12:15 in the fireplace room. The interviews were shot largely at the World Conference of Religion and Peace, held in Riva del Garda on the sublimely beautiful Lake Garda in northern Italy. It was an incredible interfaith experience. There were over 1,000 optimistic souls from every progressive end of their religions gathering to decide how best to further world peace. It included Christians, Jews, Muslims, Sufi Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, Jains, Buddhists, Shinto, Native Americans, and of course a UU, our then President John Burns. By the way, I learned where we get this. From the Jains, the 4,000-year-old northern Indian religion is a very peaceful, ethically centered belief system. Jains believe that the sound of clapping is far too disruptive and violent an expression of approval and prefer the joyful movement of peacefully moving the air moving the air like this with our hands. So, let's not hear it for the Jains. In most of the documentaries I made for public TV, there was usually one book that was especially helpful. For Divining the Divine, it was Karen Armstrong's The History of God. Its opening sentence is, "In the beginning, man created God." I felt once again I was with Kazantzakis. It made me think of our ancient ancestors, huddled around fires on dark nights for tens of thousands of years, if not hundreds of thousands, pondering the meaning of the moon and the stars and how all life came to be. Armstrong's opening line echoes Voltaire's, who 300 years earlier wrote, "If God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him." A former Episcopalian nun, Armstrong's The History of God was the first of her many books on spirituality and religion. It traces the 4,000-year history of monotheism, the monotheistic God of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which, of course, was preceded by thousands of other gods, gods for every occasion and purpose, many still alive in Hinduism and other faiths. From the very beginning, Armstrong notes, we invented stories that enable us to place our lives in a larger setting, one that revealed an underlying pattern and gave us a sense that, against all the depressing and chaotic evidence to the contrary, life had meaning and value. In her later work, We've domesticated God's transcendence. We often learn about God about the same time we learn about Santa Claus. But our ideas about Santa Claus change. They mature and become more nuanced, where our ideas of God can remain at a rather infantile level. She adds, if all religious life is reduced to getting into heaven, and all your good deeds are about getting up there, as it was for me as a child, this is no more religious than paying into a retirement annuity. I'm not interested in the afterlife. Religion and heaven are supposed to be about the loss of ego, not about preoccupation with its eternal survival in optimal conditions. Speaking of ego, deGrasse Tyson points out that if there was a huge genetic gap separating us from our closest relative in the animal kingdom, we could justify celebrating our brilliance. But no such gap exists. Instead, we're one with the rest of nature, fitting neither above nor below, but within. In Raisa Aslan's recent book, God, A Human History, he says, God isn't someone out there like you. Who can you talk to? God is in you and in everything. Pantheism is the religion of the 21st century. We believe that God is love, mercy, and compassion, but these are human characteristics of the highest order. We don't need to invent God to discover that. UU minister Victoria Safford, who was our family's minister when we lived in Northampton, Mass., wrote this about a Unitarian's perspective on God. Each of us tells the story differently, setting our words to music all our own. Your song might be about inexplicable nature, but instead might not be about inexplicable nature, but instead some kind of muscular, articulate agnosticism, or ethical humanism, or atheism, or liberal Christianity, or some kind of Western Buddhism, or an ethical, practical religion based on justice-making and action, or paganism mixed with feminism, or who knows what. You sing your song in your own key, in your own beautiful voice, and the cosmos listens reverently. The origins of humanist philosophy long predate Unitarianism, but it was Unitarians who made it a part of our values, who were instrumental in elevating it to a religious form. The UU Humanist Association was founded in 1962, and until recently, it spelled it H-U-U-A-M-I-N-I-S-M. A local group meets weekly at San Francisco's First Unitarian Church. Unitarians were instrumental in the founding of the American Humanist Association, whose logo is on the cover of today's order of service, which usually includes the phrase, good without a God. Adding to our 7 UU principles, humanists have 21 others, including, we're deeply concerned with the moral education of our children. We want to nourish reason and compassion. We're citizens of the universe and are excited by discoveries that are still to be made about our cosmos. We're engaged by the arts no less than by science and the sciences. We believe in optimism rather than pessimism, hope rather than despair, learning in place of dogma, truth instead of ignorance, tolerance in place of fear. We affirm humanism as a realistic alternative to ideologies of violence. 20 years ago, 46% of UUs reported that they regarded themselves as theologically humanist, more than twice the number who identified with the second most common perspective, a nature-centered spirituality. In 2013, the ardent UU humanist Michael Werner published Regaining Balance, The Evolution of the UUA, where he chronicles the ways that the Boston UUA establishment has been transforming from non-creedalism into anythingism, with no significant results in expanded membership. He urges restoring the Enlightenment humanism that had once been emerging and traces the many interacting forces that led the UUA to ideological extremes of indiscriminate pluralism and suggesting the secular revolution could be a possible ally for the UUA going forward. In a 2014 survey, the Pew Research Center reported that 21% of Americans had no religion, 3% being atheist, and 5% agnostic. About 14% described their religious beliefs as, quote, nothing in particular. And more than a quarter of those said they don't believe in God or a universal spirit. This looks like a large group of potential Unitarian Universalists. Bill Schultz, former UUA president, who's also president emeritus of the UU Service Committee, wrote Our Humanist Legacy, 70 Years of Religious Humanism, which was featured in the November 2003 issue of Our World magazine, UU World, which is available on its website. In it, he said, "The truth is that a lot of nonsense passes for religion in this 21st century, as it has in all the preceding centuries. Religious humanism is a willing call. Religious humanism is willing to call a charlatan, and while reason is by no means the only vehicle of religious exploration, we abandon it altogether. We abandon it altogether only at our peril." The Secular Coalition for America is the political arm of this movement. The lobby group and another group, the CFI, the Center for Inquiry, is publisher of both the Skeptical Inquirer magazine and the Council for Secular Humanism's Free Inquiry magazine, with a combined readership of nearly 100,000. Its founder, Paul Kurtz, defines secular humanists by saying, "Perhaps they're everyone who believes in the principles of free inquiry, ethics based upon reason, and a commitment to science, democracy, and freedom, maybe even you. I believe we must all accept responsibility for the way we live. And precisely because of that, we as a species must live responsibly. The penalty for not doing so is not facing the wrath of God or hell. The penalty is the degradation and destruction of our planet and of our personal morality." Carl Sagan's last book, The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark, looked at the 20th century's gathering darkness of rampant superstition and religious fundamentalism and concluded that science offers humanity its only real spiritual solace, a lone light in a dark place. He traced the history of scientists and other critically minded people who fought to expose spiritual charlatans and overturn groundless superstitions. He argued that science and democratic values will provide the foundation for an increasingly peaceful human future. He saw science as a magnificent edifice of demonstrable facts, while faith is an illusory house of imaginary cards. "For me," he wrote, "it's far better to grasp the universe as it really is than to persist in delusion, however satisfying and reassuring." But he was by no means the enemy of spirituality, which he took to be the human quest for the transcendent. When we recognize our place in an immensity of light years and the passage of ages, when we grasp the intricacy, beauty, and subtlety of life, that combination of elation, wonder, and humility is surely spiritual. "Is this worshiping at the altar of science?" he said. He asked, "Is replacing one faith with another equally arbitrary?" His answer was not at all. What sermons even-handedly examine the God hypothesis? Scriptures are said to be divinely inspired, a phrase with many meanings. But what if it's simply made up by fallible humans? Neil deGrasse Tyson puts it this way. "The issue is not religion versus non-religion or religion versus science. The issue is ideas that are different versus dogma." We humanists don't pray to a God we don't believe exists, but we do put our faith in the potential power of humanity, of the conscious human mind to exercise its wisdom, its capacity for love and mercy and rationality, for searching and discovering an understanding of the truth about our physical environment and how we really came into being as the Homo sapiens that we are, to not continue to dominate this planet for our own desires at the expense of the diversity of all the incredible life that coexists with us on this planet. Optimistic hopes for sure, based on the historical record, but it's what we have. Our collective, creative, human imaginations can and have created gods and goddesses, religions, and a heaven and hell to believe in. But we are the saviors of God. We have each other, which is all we really ever had. We need to believe it, and we need to embrace it. May it be so.